Our anti-energy knowledge system's phony enthusiasm for solar and wind. We have seen that claims that solar and wind can rapidly replace fossil fuels for electricity, let alone for other forms of energy, are based not on epic breakthroughs, but rather 1. Denial of the current small-scale, parasitical, destructive, and electricity-only reality of solar and wind energy, and 2. Reliance on non-existent economic achievements, such as a global network of endless solar panels and wind turbines, and cost-effective multi-day electricity storage. Given that we know our knowledge system operates on the anti-impact framework, including the anti-energy goal of eliminating human impact, we can reasonably conclude that our knowledge system's wild distortion of solar and wind's potential is motivated by the desire to win pro-energy people over to its anti-impact, anti-fossil fuel, anti-nuclear, anti-hydro, energy elimination policies. This conclusion is supported by 2 other pieces of evidence that show just how phony our knowledge system's seeming enthusiasm for solar and wind's potential is. Its indifference to the suffering that pro-solar and wind policies are imposing on the unempowered world, and its indifference to or participation in the growing green hostility that is stopping much solar and wind development around the world. The anti-fossil fuel movement, with seeming enthusiasm for the claimed potential of green energy, is telling the unempowered world that they need to leapfrog fossil fuels with solar panels and batteries so they can empower their citizens without emitting CO2. This is pitched as exciting and futuristic. In reality, there is no significant empowerment with solar panels and batteries, though these can sometimes be a nice philanthropic donation for very limited purposes, such as powering flashlights and charging small digital devices. And the reality of solar and wind's deficiencies keeps revealing itself, to the indifference of those who claim to be excited by solar and wind's potential. Consider the once-celebrated solar and battery microgrid of Darnai, India. Darnai, raved Greenpeace, refused to give in to the trap of the fossil fuel industry. The media celebrated Darnai as the first village in India where all aspects of life are powered by solar. But solar failed the people of Darnai. The solar battery system was too weak to power the center of villagers' lives, their cook stoves, so they still used wood and dung. And for the functions that solar theoretically could power, such as the lights, the batteries were drained within a few hours. When the state chief minister came to what was intended to be a celebratory inauguration of this solar power system, he was greeted by protesters demanding real electricity and not fake electricity. A week later, Darnai was hooked up to the national grid, powered by coal. The failure of green energy here and many other places to help empower poor people would be the object of great concern for a pro-human, pro-energy movement. But Greenpeace and other green energy enthusiasts were unmoved by this failure and continued to advocate for the abolition of the coal that was the savior of the Darnai villagers. To tell the poorest people in the world the lie that they can empower themselves with solar and wind, and to be indifferent to the suffering that occurs when they try, betrays a true devaluing of and hostility to cost-effective energy, which can only be motivated by our knowledge system's anti-energy, anti-human goal of eliminating human impact on nature. A final piece of evidence that enthusiasm for solar and wind is a disguise for an anti-energy goal is the green energy movement's indifference to or participation in the growing green hostility that is stopping much solar and wind development around the world. The appeal of solar and wind on the anti-impact framework is that they are green, that is, minimally impactful. But in reality, because solar and wind are dilute, they actually impact nature, as well as human developments, far more than fossil fuels do in many ways. As people on the anti-impact framework learn more about all the land use and mining and waste disposal involved in green solar and wind, they come to oppose solar and wind in many cases, especially when solar and wind are proposed near them. There are many instances of passionate advocates of solar and wind opposing them in their own areas, such as the Kennedy family opposing the Cape wind turbines off the coast of Cape Cod, or California anti-impact activists opposing solar panels in the Colorado desert because of the impact on desert species. There is a growing movement in the U.S. to oppose new farms of solar panels and wind turbines, as well as long-distance transmission lines. All of these increase the real-world costs of solar and wind and would prevent any kind of rapid build-out of solar and wind, even if they were cost-effective. Yet, anti-impact opposition to solar and wind is ignored by our knowledge system in its predictions of a revolution in solar and wind. And advocates of solar and wind seem to have no real concern about the opposition to solar and wind. But their concern about rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use continues without a hitch. Once again, the goal is not to replace ultra-cost-effective energy from fossil fuels with something superior. It is to stop energy use from impacting nature so much, which means stopping energy use. We must keep our knowledge system's anti-energy nature in mind as we look at other green alternatives, so we are aware that our knowledge system will inevitably distort the evidence about green alternatives to justify eliminating fossil fuels and nuclear and hydro. And even if any of those alternatives do have significant replacement potential, our anti-impact knowledge system will oppose them in practice for having too much impact. The truth about biomass. We've now seen that our knowledge system, with its flagship promoted alternatives to fossil fuels, solar and wind, wildly distorts the present, wildly distorts the future, and exhibits hostility toward the impact inherent in energy that would prevent solar and wind from being cost-effective replacements, even if they had the potential to do so, which they definitely don't. Similar distortions and hostility are occurring with the second most promoted green alternative, biomass. Biomass energy is energy derived from recently living plant or animal matter, whether alcohol, wood, crops, crop waste, grass, or animal dung. Biomass emits CO2 when burned, but is often considered to be roughly carbon neutral because biomass also absorbs CO2 before it is burned. We are told that biomass can, along with solar and wind, help replace fossil fuels. The plausibility of biomass as a replacement is that it has somewhat similar properties to fossil fuels in its ability to store and concentrate energy, including to do so in liquid form. Liquid biomass is enthusiastically advocated as a replacement for oil, the hardest to replace fossil fuel. Biomass can be refined or transformed into alcohol fuels such as ethanol, approximately 50% the energy density of oil fuels, and methanol, also approximately 50% the energy density of oil fuels, or into plant oil fuels such as biodiesel, approximately 100% the energy density of oil fuels. Existing engines that use liquid oil-based fuels are far easier to adapt to biofuels than they are to battery-based or hydrogen-based mobile energy. Biomass can also be used to generate electricity. Many countries, in order to meet renewable targets that they cannot meet with unreliable solar and wind, turn to biomass in the form of wood from forests for much of their electricity. Biomass's versatility, far greater than that of solar and wind, lends credence to optimistic claims about its future. But when we look at the full reality of biomass today and its causes, it no longer looks promising when it comes to substituting for fossil fuels. For significant portions of the unempowered and barely empowered world, biomass means the use of wood and dung to cook and heat homes, which comes with significant indoor air pollution problems. Modern biomass is used to generate just a small percentage of electricity and a small fraction of mobile energy. And this is almost exclusively in areas with high subsidies or even mandates for biomass, such as the ethanol mandate in the U.S. that forces gas stations to sell gasoline with at least 10% ethanol. Why is modern biomass small and subsidized, with much biomass being primitive, high-pollution energy? It's the same problem human beings have always had with biomass. It is cost-effective when you don't have to grow it yourself, but not when you do have to grow it yourself, which means it scales very, very badly. Biomass is lowest cost when it involves pre-existing materials that energy producers do not have to grow. In the case of poorer people, it's usually pre-existing trees and animal waste. In the case of modern biomass, it's the residual or waste products of other processes, for example, discarded French fry oil, leftover crops, or waste alcohol. I remember meeting an entrepreneur who eagerly told me he sold biofuels and could easily outcompete oil-based fuels. Intrigued, I asked him what his raw material was. He said, "Waste alcohol from beer making." "That's great," I said, "but I really hope the world doesn't drink so much beer that the waste alcohol could power the world." Thus, natural or residual biomass is often the lowest cost option on a very small scale, which is why the very poorest people use it, despite its serious side effect of indoor air pollution, as well as the destruction of natural beauty that can come from clearing forest areas. But there is nowhere near enough natural or residual biomass in the world to support today's scale of energy. This means that any attempt to scale biomass use must involve continuously growing new biomass, usually through farming. New biomass always takes a lot of resources, a lot more than it costs to harness naturally concentrated and stored fossil fuels. Specifically, it takes all the usual resources involved in farming, including large amounts of energy, machinery, water, fertilizer, time, and land. And the land involved is not any old land. While you can site a coal plant or nuclear plant just about anywhere, biomass usually requires valuable farmland. It is already an achievement to use all the world's farmland to produce food calories for 8 billion people. In the empowered world, the average person uses many dozens of times more machine calories than food calories. There is simply nowhere near enough farmland to provide global scale energy. And the more we attempt to use farmland to produce energy, the more cost problems we will have as unprecedented demand for farmland drives up prices. What about the future? Hypothetically, biomass could become a more significant supplement with two concurrent breakthroughs. One, the ability to produce biomass using huge amounts of extremely cheap land. Two, the ability to, on that extremely cheap land, achieve unprecedented crop density. I have seen no evidence that either of these breakthroughs is anywhere close to happening. Note, though, that even if they do materialize, they will surely involve the genetic modification of crops or some other unnatural process. Thus, we can count on biomass, if it ever becomes cost-effective on a meaningful scale, being rapidly opposed by the green energy movement and by our knowledge system in general. Today, we are already seeing existing biomass increasingly opposed as it becomes known that farming for energy has a lot of impact, including enormous land use and cutting down large numbers of trees. Thus, just as our anti-impact knowledge system promotes a fraudulent solar wind future but ends up opposing solar wind development in practice, so it does with biomass, and will do so much more in the future if biomass has any true breakthroughs. Once again, our anti-impact knowledge system, motivated by the goal of eliminating human impact, wildly distorts the evidence about the potential of a green alternative and would oppose that potential if it did exist. The truth about geothermal. The final source of green energy advocated by our knowledge system as a major part of replacing fossil fuels, is geothermal energy, which is becoming more advocated as the public becomes, slowly, more aware of solar and wind's intermittency-related problems. Geothermal energy works by tapping into the Earth's geological heat reservoirs to produce heat directly, as well as by using heat to generate electricity. The appeal of geothermal is that, unlike solar and wind, it is a natural store of energy and thus far more suited to reliable energy production. Additionally, geothermal has a track record of being widespread in Iceland, mostly for residential heat and some for electricity. The success of geothermal energy in Iceland is often used as evidence that it can be used everywhere. As usual, the issue of replacing fossil fuels for mobility is ignored. But the reality is that geothermal is used dominantly in Iceland for a reason. Iceland is uniquely conducive to it. To efficiently generate heat and electricity, large geothermal plants require geological heat reservoirs that provide heat or hot steam relatively near the Earth's surface. Those exist in Iceland, but they're rare. In most places, underground temperatures near the surface hover in the 50 to 60 degree Fahrenheit range. Because of these geological limitations, modern geothermal energy's ability to scale is very limited. Today, it provides less than 1% of global energy. Geothermal as we know it is nothing resembling a scalable near-term replacement for any form of fossil fuel use. There is, however, a geothermal-based process that may have future scaling promise: ultra-deep geothermal. The basic idea is that if you drill far deeper into the Earth than you would for conventional geothermal, you can access high-temperature, high-pressure water that is better suited to generating electricity. If someone can cost-effectively drill that far and can cost-effectively capture the heat, using equipment with an incredible tolerance for high temperatures and pressures, they might be able to get reliable geothermal energy in a far wider array of locations than current geothermal can provide. This is the kind of potential that yields news stories such as, "Supercharged geothermal energy could power the planet," and claims such as, "Heat contained in the upper 3 kilometers of the Earth's crust would be enough to meet the world's energy demands thousands of times over." But remember the difference between a prototype and a large-scale economic achievement. Prototype ultra-deep geothermal projects started in the year 2000. The first prototype well began drilling in 2005. It showed some promise, but drillers hit the molten part of the rock, which the equipment couldn't handle, and the well was abandoned. The second prototype well was drilled in 2017, years after the first prototype. Its long-term goal, emphasis on long-term, is to take this thus far unharnessed source of energy from deep below Iceland and move it via a 700-mile-long deepwater cable to Scotland. So far, the world's largest underwater cable is just half as long and in shallow waters. Thus, even just the transmission involved in this ultra-deep geothermal project is speculative. Obviously, this is nothing resembling a significant near-term supplement for fossil fuels, let alone a significant replacement. Nor are the other green or renewable alternatives you may occasionally hear about, such as small hydro, waves, and tides, which are much further from ultra-cost effectiveness than geothermal. All have been around for decades, and all produce trivial percentages of the world's energy. As with solar, wind, and biomass, if geothermal somehow did become ultra-cost effective at some point, it would surely attract opposition from our anti-energy knowledge system due to the inevitably large impact on nature it would have. For example, advanced geothermal, like much oil and gas drilling, makes use of fracking in order to crack rocks and release heat. Does anyone believe that Greenpeace and the Sierra Club wouldn't come after geothermal fracking if it were widespread? Is there any chance that anti-impact hostility won't increase if deep geothermal projects are known to be drilling over 10,000 feet below the surface of the Earth? The basic truth about geothermal is the same as for the other green alternatives. There is zero reason to believe that any of them can come close to fossil fuels any time in the coming decades in producing low-cost, on-demand, versatile energy on a scale of billions of people in thousands of places. And there is every reason to believe that if they ever show any promise even as partial substitutes for fossil fuels, anti-impact forces will oppose them for impacting nature too much. Indeed, that is exactly what our anti-impact knowledge system has already done to the two most promising alternatives to fossil fuels, hydro and nuclear, which, while nowhere near total near-term replacements, are extremely significant supplements, and in the case of nuclear, a potential long-term superior replacement. The suppressed potential of hydroelectric energy. Hydroelectric energy is falling water used to generate electricity. If you've ever been in a rapidly flowing river, you can feel the immense energy of the moving water. Hydroelectric energy transforms some of that raw energy into low-cost, reliable electricity using a turbine, somewhat like a wind turbine, except driven by a far more powerful and continuous force. Hydroelectric energy produces over 6% of the world's total energy, all in the form of electricity, most of it low cost. While hydro is a valuable form of energy, its ability to scale is severely limited by lack of suitable water sites. In China and Brazil, the two top users of hydro, residents can get a lot of electricity from it. In Nebraska, they can't. In the U.S., there is theoretically still some significant hydroelectric potential, but it is blocked by anti-impact opposition to new dams and the expanding bans on developing lands by the federal government. While hydro cannot provide global-scale electricity, let alone all energy, for the growing needs of the future, there is considerably more opportunity to develop hydro in many places. Based on the range of dammable rivers left, the International Energy Agency estimates that hydroelectricity has the technical potential to grow 92% in Africa and 80% in Asia. Worldwide, it estimates, hydro has the technical potential to produce up to 4 times as much energy as it does today. While this doesn't make hydro anything resembling a replacement for fossil fuels, it makes it a very valuable, growing supplement. If you didn't know that the anti-impact framework is driving much of today's opposition to CO2 emissions, you would think this was an exciting prospect to those who claim to want low-cost, reliable energy without the CO2. You might think they would welcome a potentially 4 times greater supply of low-cost, reliable, non-CO2-emitting hydroelectricity. But knowing that the anti-impact framework is behind most opposition to CO2, it should be no surprise that most anti-fossil fuel groups also oppose hydro, or sometimes what they call big hydro, which is almost all the world's hydro. In fact, they oppose not only the growth of hydro, but also existing hydro. Anti-impact activists have spent decades shutting down as many hydroelectric dams as they can, particularly large hydroelectric dams, in the name of protecting fish species and free-flowing rivers from the evil of human impact. The Sierra Club, on its list of accomplishments on its website, lists dams it has prevented or shut down. Why? Hydro's significant impact on nature is considered unacceptable, even though hydro could significantly reduce CO2 emissions. The Sierra Club, for instance, acknowledges that hydro produces no air pollution or global warming pollution, but says that because of the effects of large dams on wildlife and watersheds, the club does not support large-scale hydropower. Once again, we see that the green energy movement is not about energy, even cost-effective non-CO2-emitting energy. It is about sacrificing energy and other human values to the idle of unimpacted nature. One seeming exception to the green energy movement's anti-impact opposition to hydro is the advocacy by some 100% renewable advocates for hydro. Perhaps the most prominent is Stanford environmental science professor Mark Jacobson, who advocates what he calls WWS, wind, water, sunlight, with water compensating for the intermittency of solar and wind. Jacobson has come under widespread and highly justified criticism for some staggering distortions of reality, including modeling the electricity potential of rivers at more than 10 times their demonstrated potential, and making confident forecasts on the basis of technologies that barely exist even in prototype, such as hydrogen planes. But I want to focus here on the fact that Jacobson and other seeming advocates of hydro do nothing of substance to counter the enormous anti-hydro faction within the green energy movement. Jacobson continues to tell the world that we can easily get all our energy from wind, water, and sunlight when opposition by the movement he is part of is making that impossible physically, in addition to its economic impossibility. Once again, the green energy movement is all about the goal of eliminating human impact and is happy to distort reality in pursuit of that goal. The suppressed potential of nuclear energy. Nuclear energy works by taking a radioactive material, usually uranium or plutonium isotopes, thorium has shown considerable potential as well, and stimulating it in a way such as to release the unfathomable amount of energy that holds the nuclei of the atoms together. I've stressed repeatedly that fossil fuels have the advantage of being a naturally stored, concentrated, and abundant source of energy. Nuclear energy has this advantage to a far greater degree. Oil's amazing energy density makes it the fuel of mobility and arguably the most valued material in the world. Well, the concentration of energy in uranium is more than a million times that of oil and 2 million times that of coal. Given current technology, in practice, it delivers only thousands of times more energy density than oil and coal. To make the potential even more exciting, the raw materials for nuclear are far more abundant in nature than even fossil fuels. So nuclear has massive scalability potential. While nuclear is currently used mostly for electricity, it has exciting versatility potential, including mobility, industrial heat, and residential heat. Take heavy-duty transportation, where mobile nuclear power has been allowed and applied, mostly in military applications, it has performed amazing feats. Modern aircraft carriers can go 20 years without refueling, with all the fuel stored in a relatively small space. Modern nuclear submarines can go for decades without refueling. In addition to potential for heavy-duty transportation, nuclear has clear potential to generate all kinds of heat, including very high levels of heat for industrial purposes. Nuclear works by using nuclear reactions to generate very high amounts of heat, which are then used to power a turbine that generates electricity. But there is no reason why nuclear's high amounts of heat can't be used for industrial or residential purposes. And unlike biomass or hydro, nuclear has no inherent limitations on scale. It can be used indefinitely, and because its fuel is so concentrated, it can be transported and used anywhere. Nuclear is full of plausible, exciting possibilities. Thus, even more so than for hydro, if you didn't know that the anti-impact framework is driving much of today's opposition to CO2 emissions, you would think nuclear would be a thrilling prospect to those who claim to want cost-effective energy without the CO2. But knowing that the anti-impact framework is behind most opposition to CO2, it should be no surprise that the most vocal opponents of fossil fuel CO2 emissions are the biggest hindrance to nuclear progress. As I described in Chapter 2, our anti-impact knowledge system has demonized and virtually criminalized nuclear energy using the rationalization of safety, even though in theory and in practice, nuclear energy is the safest form of energy. The opposition to nuclear on safety grounds is a smokescreen for the real motivation of its anti-impact opponents. Their hatred of nuclear because it impacts nature in ways they consider morally unacceptable. Even though nuclear is the safest form of energy for human beings, on the anti-impact framework, it is morally dangerous because it deals in unnatural, high-energy, radioactive materials and processes. The clearest example of the anti-impact mentality behind opposition to nuclear is the deep aversion to benign nuclear waste storage because it is unnatural, human-made, and will last too long. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, nuclear fuel remains dangerously radioactive for thousands of years after it is no longer useful in a commercial reactor. The resulting waste disposal problem has become a major challenge for policymakers. In reality, as energy and environment expert Michael Schellenberger has pointed out, if all the nuclear waste from U.S. power plants were put on a football field, it would stack up just 50 feet high. In comparison to the waste produced by every other kind of electricity production, that quantity is close to zero. Given how little waste there actually is, it can be safely and affordably stored on site as it is today, and eventually used as fuel for more advanced nuclear plants. What is truly disturbing to anti-impact opponents of nuclear energy is that human beings are creating something unnatural that will be around for a long time. That's no problem on a human flourishing standard, but on an unimpacted nature standard, it is the highest of sins. The anti-impact framework standard of eliminating human impact makes many people believe that nuclear is intrinsically immoral. And on the anti-impact framework's delicate nurture assumption, something so impactful and unnatural has to lead to disaster. Safety concerns, motivated by the anti-impact framework, have led the nuclear industry to become an essentially government-controlled industry, which, like many a government-controlled industry, has higher prices than others. Any activity, no matter how potentially cost-effective, can become cost-prohibitive with enough safety requirements. Imagine you are a software engineer who can produce $200,000 a year in value for a company, but the government requires you to have a full-time security detail of five people, each costing $75,000. It wouldn't make sense for any employer to hire you. That's the situation nuclear is in. It has to deal with safety requirements that would cripple any form of energy, despite the fact that it is the safest form of energy. Thus, we don't really know what nuclear electricity would cost without the pseudoscientific opposition, and we have no idea what nuclear could do outside the realm of electricity. There is good reason to think that if nuclear energy is decriminalized, in the long run, it can produce low-cost, on-demand energy that can meaningfully supplement and someday even replace fossil fuels. If we were indeed facing an existential catastrophe from rising CO2 levels, a rapid build-out of nuclear electricity using today's technology would be essential to any plausible response. In the best-case scenario, though, nuclear is still decades away from scaling to become the leading global source of electricity, let alone somehow providing transportation solutions at the level oil can. To give you an idea of how long it will take to scale up nuclear, to replace all existing fossil fuel energy of all kinds with nuclear by the end of 2050 would require building 4 1-gigawatt nuclear power plants every day, starting in January 2022. In the last 30 years, on average, 4 gigawatts of nuclear capacity have been created only every 540 days. In fact, nuclear is so hamstrung that nuclear energy around the world is declining. The fact that the anti-impact movement expresses little or no concern about this decline and is in fact driving it demonstrates that its goal is not to get maximum energy with minimum CO2, but to oppose human impact, including energy, as such. Having explored the final hypothetical alternative to fossil fuels, we can conclude two things. One is that there are no near-term replacements for fossil fuels' uniquely cost-effective energy production, only supplements. The other is that our knowledge system's push for green energy is an anti-energy movement driven by the anti-impact framework. Because its overriding goal is eliminating human impact on nature, and all energy involves significant impact, it finds a way to oppose any form of energy that's remotely cost-effective. It is only in favor of imaginary energy solutions, such as solar and wind backed up by unlimited batteries, whose potential it fabricates to get us to support its opposition to fossil fuels, nuclear, and hydro. The anti-impact green energy movement is therefore a menace to our future, spreading deadly lies about energy to achieve deadly anti-energy goals. It can be counted on to continue to deny the reality that fossil fuels will, for many decades to come, remain the only source of energy that can provide ultra-cost-effective energy production. Low-cost, on-demand, versatile, on a growing global scale of billions of people in thousands of places. And it can be counted on to oppose anything truly cost-effective. This is crucial to keep in mind when you hear the next breakthrough in alternatives, so that you realize that the breakthrough is likely not even close to what the knowledge system is portraying, and if it was a real breakthrough, our anti-impact knowledge system would oppose it. The truth about capturing CO2. We now know that there are no scalable replacements for fossil fuels over the next several decades. Certainly nothing that could enable us to restrict, let alone eliminate, fossil fuel use by 2050 without mass devastation and death. Since most of the concern about fossil fuel use involves CO2 emissions, it is natural to ask the question, can we continue to use fossil fuels and use technology to somehow capture the CO2? The answer, not cost-effectively. There are two main proposed approaches to CO2 capture, direct and indirect. Direct capture involves capturing the specific CO2 emitted in a given use of fossil fuel, such as capturing the CO2 in the exhaust of a coal-fired power plant. A coal or natural gas plant using carbon capture and sequestration is an example of this approach. Indirect capture involves capturing CO2 from anywhere in the world to offset the CO2 emitted from a given fossil fuel use. This is the approach involved in myriad types of carbon offsets. Both direct and indirect CO2 capture are incredibly small today, due to fundamental problems with cost at scale. In 2019, the world emitted over 36 billion metric tons of CO2. The amount captured directly or indirectly was 1/1,000th of that amount. Why? The reason is the same as with many of the other processes I have covered. It is prohibitively costly to do at scale. Let's look first at direct capture. Direct capture at scale is much more plausible than indirect capture because of the physics involved. Direct capture involves capturing a stream of CO2 emissions directly from a power plant or other source, where they exist in very high concentration. Physically, it's much easier to capture something in high concentration than it is to capture something in low concentration, as we'll see for air capture methods of indirect CO2 capture. But even direct capture is nowhere near scalable at low cost. On a small scale, it is actually not only low cost, but profitable when CO2 is captured directly from where it is emitted and then funneled to some industrial process where it will be useful and companies will pay for it. For example, oil drillers will pay for captured CO2 because they can inject it into the ground to facilitate oil production. The pressure of the CO2 helps get more oil from the ground. But in this process, we can see a major element of non-scalability. There is only so much oil production in the world, providing the capacity to utilize only a small fraction of our annual CO2 emissions. All the proposed methods of capturing CO2 profitably, usually for industrial purposes, have the same scalability problems. The basic math is that only about 230 million tons of CO2 are used by industry globally, compared with the tens of billions of tons emitted by human beings every year. Therefore, there is nothing resembling a way to profitably capture even 1% of the world's emissions. What about capturing them at a small loss so that fossil fuel energy would be only slightly more expensive, but without the CO2 emissions? There is no evidence that this can be done on a large scale. One big challenge of directly capturing CO2 at scale is where it gets stored. CO2 is a gas that takes up a lot of space. There are proposals to store CO2 underground, on the seafloor, or in some other form that is stable and prevents re-emission over a long period. Some initial experimentation has shown promise in locking up CO2 in rock formations. But there is nothing that can handle any significant fraction of our annual emissions without making energy far more expensive. As bad as all these obstacles to scale are for direct capture of CO2, the situation for indirect capture of CO2 is far worse. All forms of indirect capture face the physical concentration problem I mentioned earlier. They are trying to get CO2 not out of an exhaust stream where it is highly concentrated, but out of normal air where it exists in very low concentrations. The most physically elegant way to extract CO2 from normal air is via plants. Thus, many carbon offset programs involve planting trees or restoring mangroves and salt marshes that at least possibly lead to a net removal of CO2 from the atmosphere. The accounting behind how much CO2 these things actually remove is highly questionable. And the more tree planting we engage in without any commercial purpose, the more there is a risk of setting off new wildfires that will actually emit a lot of CO2. Numerous carbon offset programs have already been wiped out via wildfires involving the carbon-capturing trees. What is certain about planting-based indirect capture is that it is not scalable to world energy use. Global CO2 emissions cannot be offset by global planting, even if everything works perfectly. It's easy to sell low-hanging fruit planting-based carbon offsets to wealthy people who are concerned about CO2 emissions. But very little is accomplished, and the people buying these scarce offsets are actually preventing poorer people from buying them. Because planting-based indirect capture is so limited, there is increasing interest in the thus far economically ruinous practice of air capture, pulling CO2 not from power plant exhaust, where it is concentrated, but out of normal air. It is thus far economically ruinous because of the recurring problem of indirect capture. CO2 exists in very small concentrations in normal air, so capturing it uses a lot of energy and costs a lot of money. To put some numbers to this, the leading direct air capture project in Iceland charges the equivalent of $10 per gallon of gasoline to remove CO2 from the air. And there is evidence that even this price is subsidized, plus it does not account for all the CO2 emitted in building and powering the project. Obviously, this would be ruinous, even to most in the empowered world, let alone to people in the Gambia who are trying to get their first reliable electricity connection. If we remember that it takes enormous innovation and achievement to turn even a promising prototype into something scalable, and there are no promising, potentially scalable prototypes in the world of CO2 capture, there is nothing on the horizon. While it is certainly legitimate to look into these things, we have no reason to expect that continuing fossil fuel use will lead to anything but continuing CO2 emissions. What this means is that there are no real near-term alternatives, not only to fossil fuel use, but also to CO2 emissions for the foreseeable future. Continuing fossil fuel use, a fundamental and irreplaceable value. We've now looked at all of the alternatives to fossil fuels, free of the distortions of our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system, and the evidence is clear. Fossil fuels, including CO2 emissions, are an irreplaceable source of the ultra-cost-effective energy that the world desperately needs more of. Because ultra-cost-effective energy is what makes the world's extreme productive ability, and therefore unnatural livability, possible, continuing and expanding fossil fuel use is essential to the livability of our world going forward. All the apocalyptic language we hear about the future climate side effects of fossil fuels actually applies to the policies designed to eliminate those side effects. This is the case regardless of what the impacts of CO2 emissions happen to be, even if they themselves turned out to be apocalyptic, which we should be highly skeptical of, given what we've seen so far, about the power of fossil fuel climate mastery, as well as our knowledge system's consistent practice of catastrophizing fossil fuels' negative side effects. If a knowledgeable person on a pro-human framework believed that CO2 emissions were catastrophic or apocalyptic, they would view the situation as an unprecedented tragedy. The energy source that makes the planet livable will also render it unlivable. But we do not see this from our knowledge system at all. Instead, it is commonplace to express unmitigated enthusiasm about the prospect of losing fossil fuels. That view is captured by a popular cartoon that illustrates the supposed consequences of rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use. The speaker is documenting all the positive consequences of eliminating fossil fuel use, including livable cities, clean water, healthy children, and green jobs. The speaker in this cartoon lists no negative consequences because the mainstream knowledge system tells us that there are no real benefits that will be lost if we rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use. Thus, even if fossil fuels actually wouldn't cause climate apocalypse, it's worth it to rapidly eliminate them. Hence the comedic rhetorical question of the audience member, what if it's a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? The view that continuing fossil fuel use has no real benefit, and thus that eliminating it has no real harm, exists at the highest levels of influence. For example, Biden administration climate envoy John Kerry, one of the world's most consequential influencers of energy policy, says, if the worst-case scenario about climate change, all the worst predictions, if they never materialize, what will be the harm that is done from having made the decision to respond to it? We would actually leave our air cleaner. We would leave our water cleaner. We would actually make our food supply more secure. Our populations would be healthier because of fewer particulates of pollution in the air, less cost to healthcare. Those are the things that would happen if we happened to be wrong and we responded. Kerry, and our knowledge system more broadly, is unperturbed by serious consideration of the billions who lack energy, the actual state of alternatives, and the green opposition to every alternative in proportion to its cost-effectiveness. Leaders like Kerry just know that opposing impacts on nature, like CO2 emissions, is good, because their goal is eliminating human impact, and because they believe in the delicate nurturer assumption. If we just eliminate our impacts, we protect ourselves from catastrophe, and nature will nurture us just fine. The ability to treat the fundamental, irreplaceable value of continuing fossil fuel use as being of zero value demonstrates just how distorting our knowledge system's anti-impact framework is. We need the awareness of both fossil fuels' fundamental, irreplaceable value and the distorting power of the anti-impact framework as we evaluate the one side effect of continuing fossil fuel use that could potentially cause new and serious problems going forward, rising CO2 levels. We need the awareness that continuing fossil fuel use is literally responsible for the incredibly livable and improving empowered world that billions today enjoy and billions more aspire to, a world that is unprecedented in its nourishment, safety, including unprecedented safety from climate danger, and opportunity for fulfillment. We need the awareness that without fossil fuels, that world will largely disappear for billions and be indefinitely unavailable to the billions that seek empowerment, and therefore that proposals to eliminate fossil fuel use are a guaranteed apocalypse from a human flourishing perspective. Recall that our knowledge system, on the delicate nurturer assumption, teaches us to fear any impact on the natural state of the planet by our energy use as an existential threat. But this is exactly backward. We should regard not massively impacting the planet using ultra-cost-effective energy as an existential threat. While Earth is not a delicate nurturer, the modern fossil-fueled world in a very real sense is. Without ultra-cost-effective energy production, our machines stop working, and we regress to trying to deal with this naturally deficient and dangerous planet using weak manual labor. A recent illustration of this in practice is the tragedy of Venezuela. Once one of the wealthier South American countries, largely due to oil production, Venezuela had a well-functioning electrical grid and fuel distribution system, making possible significant opportunity to flourish. But when the country passed socialist policies, one consequence was the collapse of its energy systems. Without all the machines that supported Venezuelans' lives, the values that had once seemed ample, clean water, ample food, warmth on demand, substantially disappeared. Millions fled the country, and the average resident lost 25 pounds involuntarily due to near starvation. As one Caracas resident put it, "We've returned to the Middle Ages." They've returned to the Middle Ages because they've returned to nature. They've regressed to a more natural level of productivity, which means a life where the vast majority of time is spent acquiring the barest necessities, and there is little time for everything else. If we don't want to return to the Middle Ages, we must make any and all decisions keeping in mind the context of the fundamental value of fossil fuels to the livability of our world. We must also keep in mind the fact that our anti-impact knowledge system is a menace that has totally distorted the reality of fossil fuels' value in service of its goal of eliminating human impact. Both the fundamental irreplaceable value of fossil fuels and the reality-distorting nature of our anti-impact knowledge system will be essential context as we explore what our knowledge system claims is a catastrophic or apocalyptic threat to our future: rising CO2 levels.